Well, you've heard the phrase, loose lips sinks ships. And I would say that loose lips sinks families, friends. Loose lips sinks churches. And the phrase comes from World War II, which I love to talk about World War II, kind of my favorite time of history. But the phrase comes from World War II in a very particular time. It came at a time in history when all of a sudden, because of technology, information had to be guarded at a whole different level. And so in about 1941, 1942, World War II was getting going, and the U.S. War Department realized that they had to do some work to keep mouths closed, because they realized that if people are talking and they're saying too much, it could literally cost lives. And so what came out were all of these patriotic slogans about all kinds of things related to words. And here are a few of them. I really like the one in the middle. I don't know if you can see it. It says, there's an award for careless talk, and it has that swastika right here in the middle. There's a remake up here, loose lips might sink ships. Loose tweets, and it says, sinks fleets. I like that. That's kind of fun. Kind of an updated version of that. I do have a favorite one that isn't actually part of World War II. But it relates to the same topic. It's quoted by Mark Twain. It's quoted by Winston Churchill and Ben Franklin and many others. And it says this, if I had had more time, I would have written a shorter letter. If I had more time, I would have written a shorter letter. And that makes me smile because it just seems like sharing, you know, too much information, TMI, is just kind of part of being a human. Well, if you go back to World War II, at the same time that this propaganda push for keeping your mouth closed and the fear of sharing too much information was being pushed by the War Department, there was a Kentucky Democrat that was a part of the House Military Affairs Committee. His name was Andrew May. And he traveled around after America got in the war. He traveled around to the Pacific Theater, and he saw different places, saw things, what was going on, and came back to America, and he gave a press conference, and he shared some of what he learned. One of the things that he said was this, Americans don't have to worry about the safety of their submarines because the Navy had found that the Japanese were setting their depth charges, kind of a type of anti-submarine explosive, to detonate at shallow enough depths that the subs could avoid them. That phrase was then reprinted in Hawaii and Japan. Soon, the Japanese rectified the situation with the depth charges. And later on, only about a month later, a guy named Charles Lockwood, who was the vice admiral, he commented on what this guy said. And he said, I hear Congressman May said the depth charges are not set deep enough. He'd be pleased to know that now they set them deeper. And he said, because of his words, we know at least 10 subs have been downed and 800 seamen lost. Now, what's interesting about the story with Andrew May is he didn't say anything untrue, did he? He wasn't spreading a lie, he wasn't spreading a gossip. He said what was true. So it's not that he misled, it's just what he said is something that he should not have said, even though it was true. And I find that very interesting because loose lips sink ships, and families, and businesses, and churches, and friendships. And you guys know that to be true. And so what we're going to find today in this story about this lesser-known character of the Bible, this guy named Doeg the Edomite, we're going to find that he didn't lie. He told the truth. It was the absolute truth. But the intent in sharing the truth cost lives. His loose lips literally cost the lives of an entire town. And I want to show you that story. If you open up your Bibles to 1 Samuel Chapter 21, 1 Samuel 21. Now, certainly Doeg the Edomite is certainly not one of those characters that you're like, yeah, I know all of his story. He's really a lesser known part of the Bible. But I want to tell you a story because I think it's so apropos for culture and life and for us to consider and think about our words. So before we get to chapter 21, let me tell you what's going on so we kind of pick up the context a little bit. At this point of the story, David has been anointed as the next king of Israel. He has not yet ascended to the throne. He's already killed Goliath, and so his fame is big and wide all over Israel. King Saul has already tried to kill him, so David is on the run. He's living out in the fields. He knows that his life is in danger, but he's still young. Now, from just an age point of view, we know David was probably about 15 or 16 years old when he killed Goliath. Now, we know that because the war that his brothers, remember, his three brothers went off to war, David did not. At that point, all 20-year-old males, 20 and over, had to go off to war. So David and his younger brothers didn't have to go off to war because they were not yet 20. Now, David's the youngest. Three go off to war. There are five that do not go off to war, with David being the youngest. So best case scenario, he's 15. He might have actually been younger than that, but he's still a young guy. So when we get to this part of the story, David is maybe early 20s, maybe just 20. He's a young guy. He's just starting to gather these ruffians, these outlaws, these malcontents around him to kind of form his own little sub-kingdom within the kingdom of Israel. But the point is that he's running for his life, and he's learning how to lead people, and he's learning how to survive out on his own. Yes, in the fields and the forests and rivers, but really surviving off the goodwill of the people. So that's where we pick up the story. Here's what it says in verse 1. 1 Samuel chapter 21, verse 1. It says, "Then David came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech came to meet David trembling and said to him, 'Why are you alone and no one with you?' And David said to Ahimelech the priest, 'The king has charged me with a matter and said to me, let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you and with which I have charged you. I've made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever is here.' And the priest answered David, 'I have no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have kept themselves from women.' And David answered the priest, 'Truly women have been kept from us, as always when I go on an expedition. The vessels of the young men are holy, even when it is an ordinary journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy?'" Well, let me tell you a little bit as we get going in the story here. We aren't exactly sure where this city of Nob actually was. We have a couple clues along the way. Nob, that word Nob means a high point, so it was probably a city on top of either a hill or a mountain. It's funny that this is the same word that sometimes we use in the English language. Like if you look at a hill and there's an outcropping on the hill, you might say, "Hey, you see where that knob is sticking out of the side of the hill? That's this word. It's kind of a something that juts out on its own." And we still kind of use this same word from time to time, even in English. Danielle's dad was a pastor right at the base of Pine Knob Ski Resort. Remember that, Danielle? We haven't been there in years. But Pine Knob, you have this place in Michigan. You know, Michigan's kind of flat. Well, not as flat as other states that I know of, but really flat. And out of this flat spot, there is this knob that sticks up, and they have a ski resort on top of Pine Knob. It's the same word here. So we know that Knob was probably on a high point, a high place, something that jutted out of the ground, maybe on top of a mountain. We also know that Nob was a sacred city, and it was populated almost exclusively by priests. So when Israel, just a little bit of history here, when Israel came into the Promised Land, remember they had to fight all the battles, they had to conquer all of the people, they had to do all of that work. One of the things that they established early on was the location of the tabernacle. Remember, we talked about the tabernacle last week. They had to carry the tabernacle. Every time God said it's time to move, they had to pack up the tabernacle and move it. Well, when they came into their permanent promised land in Canaan, they had that tabernacle that used to be portable that they now made semi-portable at a place called Shiloh. And for 369 years, that tabernacle sat at Shiloh. And early on in the story, every time you read about the tabernacle or you read about Shiloh, it was always that semi-permanent tabernacle, many of the same curtains and rods and bases and sacred items that they had carried for 40 years in the desert were all now housed at Shiloh. In fact, when you get to the story of Samuel, remember the story of Samuel? He's in the tabernacle. The Lord calls his name. He thinks it's Eli. He runs to Eli. Well, that all takes place in Shiloh because that's where the tabernacle was. That was kind of the holy city of Israel. Well, the Philistines came along and they made war against Israel. And one of the things that they did was they sacked Shiloh. And for some reason that we don't know, they did not take the temple. The best guess that we have is that the Israelites knew that the Philistines were coming, so they packed up the semi-permanent tabernacle, they packed up the curtains, and they packed up the rods and the bases and the holy sacred items. They packed them all away and hid them, so when Shiloh fell to the Philistines, they still had the tabernacle, which is an advantage when you have a portable tabernacle. You can hide those things and rebuild it in a new location, which they did. And the location that they rebuilt the new tabernacle after Shiloh fell was the city of Nob, up on top of a mountain, a high place. Now, if you fast forward through Israel's history, you find that they began to build holy places on top of high places. This actually began with the building of the tabernacle on top of this high place that we know of as Nob. Now, we also know the tabernacle was there because in this story here, in these verses that we read, We know that David asked for bread. They didn't have any fresh bread on hand, which is a little bit strange, but they did have what the text says is showbread or consecrated bread. This was bread that was inside the tabernacle. It was baked weekly. It was consecrated to the Lord. It was set up on the furniture inside the tabernacle, and after a week, it was removed, and new fresh bread was put into place. So when Ahimelech said, "Hey, I don't have any bread except the consecrated bread," it was the bread from the tabernacle, this holy, the show bread, this consecrated bread to the Lord. And probably what happened was Ahimelech went in and took the consecrated bread from inside the tabernacle and gave that bread to David. So we know that when David goes to Nob, he goes to the tabernacle, and we know that showbread was in the tabernacle. We know that Nob was the sacred city filled with priests, all of whom had the job of keeping up and offering sacrifices inside the temple. So the high priest Ahimelech offers bread to David, and he says, "I can only give you this bread if your men are ceremonially clean," which is a really interesting thing because there's so many things that are a part of being ceremonially clean, not just this question of whether they've kept themselves from women. There's all kinds of things. But it could be that by this point in history, all these years after Mount Sinai, which is 400 years earlier, maybe they whittled down all of the law around being ceremonially clean to just one thing, and that was the relations between man and women. Now, according to the Old Testament law, relations between a man and a woman, even if it's husband or wife, made the couple unclean until the evening. So when we come to David's response, which, by the way, I love his response. I don't know if you noticed the turn of phrase. Ahimelech said, "Men, have you kept yourselves from women?" And David says, "Well, women have kept themselves from us." But if you think about that, you have a bunch of guys riding on horses out in the sun, fighting battles week after week. Why do you think the women kept themselves from the men? Yeah. At least that's the way I read it here. Let's continue with the story. Verse 6. So the priest gave him, that's to David, the holy bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, that's that showbread, that consecrated bread, which is removed from before the Lord to be replaced by hot bread on the day it is taken away. Look at verse 7. Now there was a certain man of the servants of Saul that was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg, the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen. Then David said to Ahimelech, "Then have you not here a spear or sword at hand? For I brought neither sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste." And the priest said, "The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you struck down in the valley of Elah, behold, it is here wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it, for there is none but that here." And David said, "There is none like that. Give it to me." So David takes the bread, gives it to the men, and they eat this consecrated bread. By the way, Jesus actually refers to this story later on when he's pressed by the Pharisees. We don't have time to look at it today. But he takes the bread, he gives it to the guys, and they have a stomach full. But he also takes Goliath's sword. Now, maybe you don't know it, but there's only two places in all of Scripture that we read about Goliath's sword. One, of course, is after David slings the stone and knocks the Goliath out. It says he takes out his sword and he cuts off Goliath's head. That's the first time we read about it. The only other time that we read about the story of Goliath's sword or anything related to Goliath's sword is right here. But what's interesting is, why is that sword in the holy place? Why is it located behind the ephod? Well, if you think about it, the sword of Goliath represented how the Lord came, the Lord's presence, how the Lord helped Israel. It had become kind of an icon in Israel by this point. So for it to be in the sacred town, in the sacred place, maybe even in the tabernacle itself, is really not that big of a surprise. Now, if you're a guy, you want to know all about the sword. Women, you can just kind of pretend you're not listening. Just let me tell you a little bit about the sword. We don't know anything about it. That's all I got. We can make a couple guesses. We know that he had a sword. Goliath had a sword. David pulled it out and whacked off Goliath's head. So we know there was a sword. We know that most of his armor was made out of bronze. And his spear, you know, weighed 15 kilos and all of that. But it doesn't tell us much about the sword. It could be that a guy that big, his dagger was as big as a sword. We don't know. We don't know if this was a big, massive, like two-handed sword. We just don't know. Except that evidently it wasn't too hard for David as a 14 or 15-year-old to pull it out and take off Goliath's head. And evidently here in this story, David felt like it was a sword that wasn't too heavy for him to wield. So he takes Goliath's sword. And so with their bellies full from the bread, and David now with his big sword on his back, probably big sword, they leave Nob. But almost parenthetically, we have verse 7. And in verse 7, it says that on his way out of town, he makes eye contact with Doeg the Edomite. And this is our first introduction to this guy. So it's Doeg the Edomite. He's always referred to as Doeg the Edomite. For us, that maybe doesn't mean a lot, but the Edomites were the enemies to Israel. In fact, in chapter 14, just back seven chapters, Saul fights the Edomites. Now you fast forward and you have one of the Edomites that's inside like the confidential circle for Saul. And here it says that Doeg was one of Saul's herdsmen, probably chief herdsmen. Now it's really interesting. He might have been in charge of all of Saul's sheep. He might have been the head of all the shepherds. But this word herdsman could also mean in charge of all that Saul had. So it could very well be that this guy, Doeg, was not just the chief of the shepherds. He seems far too close to Saul to be just the chief of the shepherds. It could be that he was functioning much more like a prime minister, kind of over all of the affairs of Saul. So he's an Edomite. How does this Edomite, this enemy of Israel, get into the inner circle with Saul? And we don't know. Some think he was a spy. Some think that he was kind of like an ambassador. We don't really know, except that he's part of the inner circle. And as David tries to slip his way out of Nob, he makes eye contact. He sees Doeg the Edomite. Now, later on in the story, David says, "As soon as I saw Doeg, I knew there was going to be trouble." So there was something in the eye contact that the two of them made, maybe across the road, maybe down some alleyways, where both recognized each other. And David said, "I knew when I saw him, trouble was coming." And he was right. Now let's fast forward in the story, chapter 22, verse 6. I'm going to read a kind of a smattering of the rest of chapter 22, so stay with me a little bit. It says, verse 6, chapter 22, verse 6, "Now Saul heard that David was discovered, and the men who were with him. Saul was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with his spear in his hand, and all of his servants were standing about him. And Saul said to his servants who stood with him, "Hear now, people of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds, that all of you have conspired against me?" That's kind of his MO. He's blaming everybody else for kind of his failure to find David. Look at verse 9. "Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who stood by the servants of Saul, 'I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine.'" Verse 16, here's what it says. "Now, and the king said to Ahimelech," so he calls for Ahimelech, "'You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house.' And the king said to the guard who stood by him, 'Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David.' And they knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me. But the servants of the king would not put out their hand to strike the priests of the Lord." Verse 18, "Then the king said to Doeg, 'You turn and strike the priests.' And Doeg the Edomite turned and struck down the priests. And he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod. And Nob, the city of the priests, he put to the sword, both man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey, and sheep, he put to the sword." We'll go all the way down to the end of the chapter. Verse 22, "And David said to Abiathar," who was one of the sons of Ahimelech, "I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, 'I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house.'" So let's back up and make sure we understand what's going on. Saul is hanging out under the tamarisk tree. He blames everybody else for his failures. And suddenly, one of his inner circle, Doeg, says, "I saw David. I know where he was." And David, he was in Nob, and he got some bread, and the priest inquired of the Lord for him. And now he has Goliath's sword. Well, Saul had a few opinions about that sword, because if you remember, after David won, beat Goliath, the women were saying, "David has killed his tens of thousands and Saul only his thousands." So I'm sure that Saul had some of those jealous feelings, and there was that sword in the middle. Now I want you to notice that what Doeg said to the king in verse 19 was absolutely true. He didn't lie. He didn't fabricate. He said the truth. And often what is shared to the detriment of someone else is the truth. Sometimes it's partial truth. Sometimes it's partial falsehood. But there's usually truth that is mixed up in there. And really, that's what gossip and slander, they're not false in content. They're not necessarily just straight out lies, but they're false in motivation. The idea behind gossip and slander, if you kind of boil both of them down, is the idea of speaking negatively about someone else or speaking in a way to hurt someone else. And that could be done with truth just as easily as it can be done with lies. So I have a little bit of some definitions up here. Gossip is the sharing of information about another, typically involving either falsehoods or partial truths. Slander is misrepresentation, which defames or damages the person. But what's interesting about both of these, especially gossip, is that gossip often begins with the phrase, "I heard dot, dot, dot." Or, "Did you know dot, dot, dot?" So you have exaggeration, you have some fabrication, you have this idea that I know something you don't know, and now I get to tell you what you don't know, often to the detriment of somebody else. And I'm sure that if we kind of went around the room, many of us would say that we have been on the receiving end of gossip and slander and negative words. And if we were really honest, we would say that at times we've been on the giving end of those. So slander and gossip. And, you know, if I could just boil those down, it's the idea of sharing something that is negative or something that makes somebody else look worse. The idea is damaging someone else. Now, I think slander is more, it's a little bit harder, it's a little more forceful, it's a little bit more deliberate. Gossip sometimes, I think, can be a little bit more innocent, but it is still hurtful nonetheless. And so the difference between gossip and slander is really in the intent. Slander tries to hurt. Gossip is a little bit lighter, but it's the same idea. Loose lips sinks people and relationships and friendships and business. And of course, in this case, Doeg said nothing that was false. He didn't say a lie. He didn't fabricate a story. He said exactly what was true. But he said it in a way and at a time to try to hurt David. That's why he did it. So in the story, Saul then calls for Ahimelech and all of his relatives. They were all undoubtedly priests. He calls them all from Nob and says, because you have helped David, you will all die. And he says, guards, kill the priests. Now, I love that the guards won't do it. I love that the guards refuse to raise a hand against God's anointed priests. Saul evidently had no problem doing it. Doeg didn't care at all about the priests of the Lord. He had no problem. But the guards, they wouldn't do it. And you almost can feel this moment of tension when the guards refuse the king. We're not going to do it. And so the king turns to Doeg, the foreigner, the spy, the slanderer, the perhaps ambassador. And Doeg kills all of the priests that had come from Nob. Kills them all. And then he marches to Nob and kills every single living thing besides the bugs in Nob. Man, woman, child. All the livestock. Completely decimates Nob. And we also know from this point on, the tabernacle, he may have destroyed part of the tabernacle because it was moved to Gibeah right after this incident. So no more worship, no longer sacred place, no longer rebuilt, all because of Doeg the Edomite. And be clear that in this moment when Saul's under the tree and he's having this conversation and Ahimelech and his father and his relatives are all there, you have the guards are there and Doeg the Edomite is there. Saul had a choice. Before him, he had, you can kind of think of like boxing. In one corner, you have Ahimelech. These are the priests of the Lord. These are the anointed of the Lord. And if you go back just a few chapters, it was Ahimelech and his family that helped Saul establish his kingdom. They were all for Saul. They were on his team. They were in one corner. And then you have Doeg the Edomite in the other corner. All Saul had to do was to listen to the right people. He had both right in front of him. But instead of listening to the anointed of the Lord, he listens to the foreigner, Doeg. And I find that very interesting. If David was a man after God's own heart, then Doeg was a man after Saul's own heart. And that's really what we see. We see Doeg as a man who killed with a sword of battle, but he killed with the sword of his tongue. And I think one of the reasons why we don't see people like Doeg very often is because when you really get into the story, it's really convicting. And we like stories with happy endings. We like Goliath stories, right? We like fun stories. But stories like this that are convicting and force us to kind of look in the mirror and go, oh my word, is that me? Those are far less fun to do. Because Doeg had a big mouth. Doeg talked about people. And if you take the E out of Doeg, you have dog. Doeg was the dog. He dogged David. And when David saw Doeg, he knew the dog would rat him out. And he did. That's Doeg. But the story of Doeg, I think, is played out all the time all around us. There are Doegs in your life. Maybe there are Doegs here. There are Doegs all around us. And they purpose in their heart for evil. They wait with information to be shared at just the right time. And especially in our culture of blogs and tweets and posts and chats and tabloids, It is easier today than ever to use our words to hurt people. And some people are really good at it. And it's not a question of truth or lies, because Doeg told the truth. It's a question of what needs to be said. There's a question of intent behind the words. But if we really think about the gossip and the slander, I mean, don't we all like to have the information that nobody else has? It makes us feel important. I know something you don't know. And if I share it with you, that guy is going down. And there's something about being the possessor of that information that makes us feel so important. And if we can really stick it to that guy that said that thing, that did that thing, or has that promotion, or is in front of us, or whatever, if we can really stick it to that person, we can hold on to that right information, that nugget of truth, until the right moment when maximum pain and hurt can be given. And then we give it. One of the tidbits of information here in the story that is very fascinating is, where was Doeg when he saw David? He was in Nob, in the sacred town, in the sacred place, maybe even in the tabernacle itself. And you would think that the safest place for David to be was in the sacred town. But evidently, there are Doegs in the most sacred of places, watching, looking, and waiting. And I think what we see in that is that you can't tell a man by where he worships, only by what's in his heart. And there are a lot of people that say a lot of things, that go a lot of places, that can show up at all the right places, but just because a person is in a church, or goes to a certain place, or goes to that Bible study, or is associated with that group, doesn't really mean as much as what's in that man's heart. So the Bible is full of all these cautions against gossip and slander. Let me just give you a few of them, because they're so wonderful, so encouraging to read and look in the mirror. 2 Corinthians 12:20, here's what it says. For I fear, now as I go through this list, look at all of the word-associated little summaries here. For I fear that perhaps when I come to you, I may find you not as I wish, and that you may not find me as you wish, that perhaps, and these are all words, that there may be quarreling, jealousy, anger, hostility, slander, gossip, conceit, and disorder there among you in the church. James 4:11, James talks about the tongue all the time, how hard it is to control. But later on in his book, he says, do not speak, that's the word, speak, do not speak evil against one another, brothers. The one who speaks against a brother judges his brother, speaks evil against the law and judges the law. Look at this last one. I love this. This is out of Proverbs. The words of a whisperer are like delicious morsels. They go down into the inner parts of the body. Isn't that how slander and gossip is? It's like when you hear that, it is so good. You want it. Oh, it's juicy. The Greek word, by the way, the Greek word for gossip means to whisper. Can't you see it? I heard. Did you know? That's this word. And I don't think any of us would be surprised, you know, if we really came to the conclusion that at times we all have problems controlling our tongue. And it can be in anger, it can be in retaliation, it can be cutting people down, it can be sarcasm to the detriment of other people. We seem to be really, really good at using our tongue to hurt other people. It's part of just being a human. So let's do just a little reflection here. Do you think that when people think about you, do they see you as a vault, a confidence keeper, or as somebody that always says too much? When people look at you and think about you, do they see you as a vault, a confidence keeper, or someone who always says too much? Because we all have reputations. Some have reputations of a trustworthy confidence keeper, and some have reputations of, you tell this person, you tell her, you tell him, everybody's going to know. Do you think people see you as a vault or as a talker? Gossip is funny because in order to have a gossip, you have to have somebody willing to listen to it. You have to have both. And it's really interesting if you try to work through that in your own heart. Are you either one? Somebody who likes to talk about other people. Maybe you're somebody that doesn't like to talk about other people, but man, do you like to get the skinny on other people. You like the goods. You like to know. You like to hear. It doesn't take much for the rumor mill just to churn away. So this week, as I was working on this, you know, I was trying to think of, you know, everything from backstabbers and busybodies and people that are opinionated and keeping our tongue under control. So a lot of you know, if you're around the church, I stopped you and I go, hey, I have a question. And so I asked all these people, how does someone know if they're a gossip and how do they stop it? And so I don't know how many people I asked. I asked a whole bunch of people. And it was really interesting. Everybody kind of went, I don't know. Because it's one of those things like, how do you tell a dough egg that he's being a dough egg? Right? Because all dough egg knows how to be is dough egg. So how do you know if this is something you struggle with? It's not like somebody's going to put their arm around you and go, hey, you know, you're a gossip. Will you stop it? We don't talk that way. We know it because we know who we can tell those secrets to, and we know who we can't. We know it. But how do you know? How does a person really say in like self-assessment, this is me? And the best idea that I got from one of you was this. This person said, the way you stop being a gossip is by first being hurt by someone gossiping about you. Then you learn the power of words. Almost like the natural inclination of all of us is to talk this way, is to have these loose lips, is to share this information until you get slammed a few times and then you realize, my words can really hurt. I love that idea. I think that's really, really wise. It's hard to learn along the way how to guard your tongue. And sometimes you really got to be hurt a few times before you realize, man, sometimes it's better not to say something. Sometimes it's better to hold that inside. Just because I know it doesn't mean I need to say it. Just because I can really stick it to him doesn't mean I have to. I can guard my tongue. And we're all going to fail from time to time. But I want us, and I want personally for me, I want to be a vault. I want to be a confidence keeper. I want you guys to see me as trustworthy. And I want us to see each other this way, that this is a safe place. There are some people that come here every week. This is a little bit of a rabbit trail, but they come here every week because they've been told this church is a safe place for you. Part of being a safe place is that we are not talking, we are not sharing, that we as a church are a place where you can come and be safe. It doesn't matter what the rumor mill is saying. It doesn't matter what you've done out there. It doesn't matter all of those things. You are safe here. And some of that is related to our ability to guard our tongue. Well, my time is late. David wrote a psalm about Doeg. You want to read it? It's kind of fun. Psalm 52. Just real quick, we'll fly through it. Psalm 52. And when you get there, you see at the top, it says that he wrote this about Doeg the Edomite. It's a short psalm, but now that you know the story, you can feel inside, you can emote with the feelings that David had towards Doeg, that he outed him. But in outing him, because of what David did, the entire city of Nob and all the priests of the Lord at Nob were all dead, and David feeling the weight of that. Psalm 52, verse 1 says, why do you boast, O evil, O mighty man? The steadfast love of God endures all the day. Your tongue plots destruction like a sharp razor, you worker of deceit. You love evil more than good and lying more than speaking what is right. You love all words that devour, O deceitful tongue. But God will break you down forever. He will snatch you and tear you from your tent. He will uproot you from the land of the living. The righteous shall see and fear and shall laugh at him, saying, see the man who would not make God his refuge, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and sought refuge in his own destruction. But I, this is David, I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the steadfast love of God forever and ever. I will thank you forever because you have done it. I will wait for your name, for it is good in the presence of the godly. So first half is like David saying, this is who you are, you deceitful tongue, you forked tongue, you giver of lies, that is who you are. But then there's this transition to the man that David wants to be. So you take gossip and you take slander and you take the busybody and all of those things, they all come from the same source. This desire for prominence, the desire to be bigger and better and smarter and for people to see us a little bit better than they used to. And you actually see that in chapter 52, like in verse 7, he trusted in his riches or he took refuge in himself. But David said to fight that tendency, and this is kind of, how do you stop being a gossip? To fight that tendency, he says, I'm like a green olive tree in the house of God. Well, FYI, there weren't any trees in the house of God. So what does David mean? Remember, the house of God, the tabernacle, represented the presence of the Lord. And he says, I'm going to throw down my roots in the presence of the Lord. And verses 8 and 9 are all about waiting and wanting this prominence for God, that his name would go great, not our own, and the strong tree that draws the sustenance from the presence of God. So his solution in this question of how do I work on guarding my tongue, what is one way that I can actually do that? David says, in this situation, the way to do that is to draw strength and presence and confidence from the presence of God. And when we do that, suddenly the need for other people to look at us as bigger and better and smarter and always having the right information, we don't need that. Because it's not about our name getting great, it's about God's name getting great. And he says, when we get to that point, the need to share and the desire to stick it to that person, those all are released and they just go away, because the goal is God's name, his greatness, not our own. And David said, this is the solution for people that struggle with it. And I think that's the question behind so much of gossip and slander. It's this need to feel valuable. Well, when you draw the strength from the presence of the Lord, the value you have is in him, not other people's applause or approval, or them going, man, you always know. Oh, you're so smart. You always got the skinny. You got all the stuff. That stuff doesn't matter when the strength comes from the presence of the Lord. So never forget that words are easily spoken, but once you get them out, you can never suck them back in. You can't. And the old kid's phrase, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. It's just not true, is it? They can hurt. Words can hurt. Guard your tongue. Don't gossip. And I think when part of what David is saying here is when God's people bank on the steadfast love of God, who has, as Jeremiah says, his mercies are new every single morning. Great is his faithfulness. David says, hey, you plant your tree right there. And when your goal in life is to make God's name great, you don't have to work at making your own name great. And he says, that's the secret to getting past the need to always having the last word and gossiping about other people. So that's the story. We've got a couple more that we're going to work on over these next few weeks. Next week, you're going to learn about a woman named Pua. Pua. She was Kula. So if you want to look up her story this next week, and then the final week is going to be on the 9+1 disciples of Christ that you know nothing about. Really, we know about Peter, James, and John and a few other ones, but what about Bartholomew? Whatever happened to him? We're going to spend the last Sunday working on that. Last thing I want to say, last week's sermon on worship, fascinating responses this week. You probably wouldn't be surprised to know I got lots of emails, texts, and phone calls. It was very interesting. I want you to know, first of all, that I plan to talk about gossiping long before the last week's sermon. So don't feel like, oh man, he's going to read my email now. That wasn't part of the plan at all. But one of the things that several people talked about, they said, I didn't know we really needed to work on that, but I want to. So I want to say that on this gossip and slander, being somewhat new here, I feel like we as a church do a pretty good job in this area. And I feel like this is a safe place. And I know people that have come here for years because they have found it to be a safe place. And I want it to increase and be even more in the future. I think many of you have done a very good job in this area. So this isn't like you guys stink in this area or anything like that. It's just something that if we are not vigilant, it would be very easy for us to not be a safe place in the future. And I don't want that. We'll continue to work on that.